Well, when Mike Campbell asked me to host the show while he was on vacation, the first thing I'm thinking about is who am I going to get? I know a lot of guys, and there's people that really, are friends of mine from a long time ago, guys I really respect. Well, I'll tell you, right at the top of the list was Greg Weldon. And I know you've heard Greg on the Money Talk show several times over the years. Greg and I go back more than 20 years when we used to have the what we call the Vancouver Gold Show. And Greg would be up here and we'd be on tour. I think we were in Calgary together and that sort of thing. Greg, you're down in Florida now. I'm on Vancouver Island, where it couldn't be much further apart from each other in North America. Welcome to Money Talks.
Thank you, Victor. I appreciate the invitation. It's always good to see you any day, time or week.
Well, listen, there's a couple of things I'd like to do. I mean, you are an analyst, you're a money manager, and you're a trader. So let's maybe do a framework for our little session here today. We'll get your views on some of the markets that people are interested in. And then what I'm really interested in, because a lot of analysts don't actually trade, and I spend most of my time trading and I try to do a little analytical work so I maybe do my trading a little better. But you and I have been trading. I mean, you were on the floors in New York, what's that, like 30 years ago. So we'll get some of your perspective on
Sure.
how to trade. And I'll give you a throwaway line here just for starts. The folks on the show here have heard me say before, I don't make money trading because I've got a great crystal ball. I make money because I really focus on managing risk.
Yeah.
And that's just so important to me. But let's start with the major macro markets. I mean, one of the keys, as Mike Campbell likes to say, if there's only one thing I could know for sure, I'd like to know where the US dollar is going, because that affects everything. Is that a good place to start? What's your thoughts on the dollar in
Well,
that
it's always
regard?
a good place to start because it really is a dominant force in all the markets. The stock market is directly, inversely correlated to the dollar, as is gold, as is the commodities markets. So, sure. I think it's interesting to see that if you tie it to Fed policy, the dollar peaked several months ago and has been coming off pretty significantly from its highs when the Fed, was in the middle of their, tightening campaign. But as now the fixed income markets shifted, maybe in October of last year, certainly by November, towards, the next narrative, which would be, Fed dovishness down the road as the economy rolled over from all the tightening. And as inflation came down, the Fed would, be back to kind of protecting the economy versus fighting inflation. So it has been discounting that shift in the Fed narrative for months. All right. Dollar down big to where it was a 20 plus percent year rate of year-over-year change to now flat. You had gold in that time frame. The dollar was up and gold was hanging in there. And all of a sudden, gold in dollar terms is also making new highs in line with, the fact that gold had made new highs in other currencies before that as well. So it's almost a question of now that the Fed is actually at the point where the narrative may change, does this mean these things correct? Because last week when the Fed, had their Powell had his press conference, or it was 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, and he had spoken to this, potential to shift the narrative that maybe there's a pause here. Well, the dollar rallied, bond yields went up. I mean, kind of counter to what you would have thought would happen in that time frame, begging the question, have the markets discounted some of that? Because if you look at the forward Fed funds, they're pricing in 150 to 175 basis points of easing by the end of next year. Now, I don't think that sits well with the Fed. The Fed has come out and said, we don't want to turn tail too quickly. The biggest policy error we could make here would be easing too quickly and allowing inflation to reach, a higher low and start to trend higher again. Now, I think that's inevitable. I think they can't avoid that. But the fact of the matter is, when the Fed looks at the pricing in the fixed income market, they don't like it because it's already pricing the next bout of rate cuts. And that kind of, first of all, removes their effectiveness. Number one. And number two is that's what's expected from the Fed. So I think there's a lot of problems with the way the market is priced right here that's causing some disruptions in the way markets might react to certain things. And I think that's going to be a little treacherous for the next few months to come. And we'll have to see how that shakes out. And I have my ideas on how it's going to shake out, but there's a lot of ways that this could go now.
Well, let me interject this thought. I see that, as you do, the forward curve and the Fed at the same time saying, and it's not just the Fed, it's also the European Central Bank, the Bank of Canada are telling people we do not expect to cut interest rates this year. Yeah. And I asked the question, so why is the market fighting the Fed? You know, I mean, did they see a recession coming in this? Yes. And my one-line answer is this. The Fed will not be cutting rates because they want to. The Fed will be cutting rates because they have to. And I think the market, and whether or not that happens, we'll see. But I think the market's making a bet that after 10 plus years of zero interest rates and then rocketing interest rates higher, that there is going to be some kind of a consequence or a calamity that's going to cause the Fed to have to change gears.
100%. You just nailed it on the head. And that's exactly what I said. I think it will play out that way anyway, because they'll be forced to. I mean, if all of a sudden the stock market loses 25%, you think the Fed's going to sit there and say, well, we said we wouldn't cut rates until the end of next year, so we're not going to. Of course not. You know they're going to move, right? But here's where it gets interesting, because this brings up the most interesting point right now. And I wrote a piece yesterday, and I likened it to the guy who was the executioner of King Louis XVI in France in 1793, and I forget his name, it was Satine or something was the guy's name, right? And I asked the question, is Jerome Powell, this guy reincarnated? I mean, is his goal to pull the guillotine down on the consumer, the economy, the labor market? And even now, if you listen to what they said over the last 2 weeks, the comments are fascinating. Powell has always done exactly what he told us he was going to do. He's been the most transparent Fed, maybe to a fault. All right. I think, you know, certainly a pandemic created more inflation than they expected. Now they're kind of struggling with this. They started raising rates way too late. All right. They were way too lame in the beginning. They could have had this over and done a while ago. You know, the base effect was going to kick in. You see inflation coming down now. But the question becomes, how much economic pain are you willing to basically inflict before you pull the plug on this whole thing around? We have to be restrictive enough to bring inflation down. They keep talking about being restrictive enough. And if you go back, and I can't help but do this every time, 1978, 1979, Paul Volcker, all the same things Jerome Powell, he's pulling from the Volcker playbook. All right. What had happened in 1982 when, you know, all of a sudden now you get this chance for Ronald Reagan to be elected? Why? Because unemployment's through the roof and people carrying around signs saying they need a job. Is that what the Fed wants? You could make an argument that, yes, that's what the Fed wants. They want to remove a level of frothiness that still remains in terms of this credit bubble for 50 years that will make sure that we don't have lower highs in inflation and a new round of inflation down the road. Which, again, I think is inevitable. I don't think they can avoid it. So the question then becomes, are they willing to talk about how many banks now have failed, what the credit situation is? A credit crunch would be the worst thing possible right now, because this economy lives on credit more than ever. The most recent quarterly Fed numbers just came out this week, all right? Fascinating numbers. Almost $1 trillion annualized rate of credit creation for U.S. households. I mean, come on, man. That's insane. The borrowing here, most of it's being done because savings have been depleted. Your paycheck buys you less by the time you get it to the bank. And people are having to borrow money to pay the bills. So how far is the Fed willing to push, and how much pain are they willing to endure, to the point where the Fed governors now are talking about, we fully expect credit to continue to contract. Victor, they're telling us we want unemployment rising. We want credit contracting. We want a recession. We want pain. And that's what we have to do to make sure we can win the battle in inflation, because that's the Volcker playbook. It worked back then. The biggest problem, of course, is you're not taking into account the debt. And already you're starting to see delinquencies rise. Already you're starting to see bankruptcies rise. You've just gotten rid of forbearance where all these people got a free pass. I mean, you know the situation is not sustainable. And the Fed is saying they're going to push until you have more pain. And they've done everything they're going to say. So why shouldn't we believe them? I mean, it's almost like, yeah, why fight the Fed right now when the Fed is telling you we want more pain and we're okay if credit contracts here? Holy mackerel.
You know, one of the one-liners, again, that I have on my blog is that inflation is not going to come down until consumers stop paying up for things. Now, consumers are going to buy groceries, you know, and groceries, it's the discretionary purchases. I mean, we've seen the word greedflation or shrinkflation. I love that one, where you look at a box of cornflakes in the Safeway, and it looks the same size, but if you turn it sideways, it's skinnier. You know, there's not as much stuff there.
I got to interrupt you, Victor. I have to interrupt you because I have sent pictures in my Walden Live of the chicken, frozen chicken things I get, of the frozen pizza I get, okay, of the wheat tin crackers, for crying out loud. It's a double-edged machete when you have smaller sizes. Now, it used to be $9.99 for a 12-pack of 12-ounce Cokes. It is now $9.99 for a 10-pack of 7.5-ounce Cokes. So, yeah, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you're so on top of it, it's not even funny. And people know this.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's the other thing I guess I've said here with Mike is that people know that the cost of things that they have to buy is going up way more than the CPI numbers would have you believe. Yeah. And people know that. So you get this whole thing about inflation expectations. And I'll just turn it over to you and let you go with inflation expectations and how you try to get that back in the barn.
Well, if you go back to kind of the guillotine coming down, I mean, frankly, the retail sales numbers this week were atrocious, Victor. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at the number of things that are down multiple months in a row, right, and they're down in price terms. In other words, this is not volume of stuff bought. This is the price. So when you take the inflation dynamic out of it, the decline is even deeper in the amount of things people are buying right now. And when I'm telling you, the last time we've had these kinds of numbers, there's only really, over the last 30 years, there's only twice. The pandemic and 2008, 2009. And we have it now. And the Fed is still this restrictive dynamic. What you have is the things that are a rolling 12-month basis in dollar terms that are lower on a month-to-month basis versus 12 months ago, all right, is pretty much every single discretionary item except eating and drinking establishments. Every single one. Furniture, garden supplies, building materials, clothing, sporting goods, appliances, electronics, vehicles, everyone is in negative territory, and we haven't seen that again. I mean, this is a recession already in terms of the consumer, and when you take into account the price increases that actually boost these numbers, holy mackerel, you see how deep it is in terms of the amount of stuff that people are buying now, and now they're actually spending less money too because they're choking so much. So the degree to which you also have now, inflation expectations had been ratcheted down. Since you want to talk inflation expectations, it's a perfect segue. Because inflation expectations have been ratcheted down. The one-year inflation expectation from the New York Fed survey, which is the best one, had gone all the way down to 3.6. It jumped in April, and it stayed up in May at 4.6. That doesn't change a full 100 basis points in a single month. Consumers don't change their minds or their opinions that much in a single month. Why did that happen? It happened because they had the largest single month that wasn't during the pandemic of money printing in U.S. history when SVB Bank failed. All right. Consumers see this. Every time there's a little hiccup, the Fed and the Treasury are going to print, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars and flood the system. And if you have to make good on $17 trillion in deposits, I mean, think about how much a loaf of bread might cost. All right. Consumers get this now. They're seeing what the Fed is doing. We're talking tough on the other hand, but the second there's a problem, we're going to pump out more money and paper it over. That's an inflation expectation. It's not going away. And the Fed is always concerned about, quote unquote, anchoring inflation expectations. I would say anchors away, because there is no anchoring anymore. And inflation expectations are high. They're going to remain high. And it's because of the Fed's action. They talk the talk, and then they walk the walk, and then they backpedal so fast it's not even funny.
So on the one hand, we've got economic data that's showing us a slowing economy, just to be really robust here. And we've got employment at a 50-year low or thereabouts at 3.4% in the United States. Unemployment, I should say. So let's go to this. What if the Fed does cut? Then what happens?
Well, I mean, then you're really kind of confirming what I think is a 50-year, 40-year at least trend reversal in interest rates and inflation. It's been lower lows and lower highs since 1982, right? It's a 40-year trend. It's a perfectly shaped trend, by the way. The geometry to all of this is mind-blowingly tight, all right? And you have reversed that. So I think that this is the case where, you know, it's kind of like the old, what was it? The old, what they call that? The new monetary, modern monetary theorist people, right? You can keep printing money forever and you won't get inflation. Well, you can keep printing money forever. You go back to the book I wrote in 2006 where I said, the path is monetary Armageddon, where they basically print enough money to buy every treasury bond ever printed. But then a loaf of bread costs $50. All right. You have turned the corner to where this is now become inflationary. You can't keep printing money like this. And in fact, believe at some point you don't have more money chasing fewer goods, the very definition of inflation, let alone we throw an El Nino into the mix and we get a whole nother rise in food prices, let alone that the base effect works off. And all of a sudden, every monthly increase in gasoline prices as these green energy nuts keep pushing for, you know, something that's supposed to save the planet when you can't save the planet. I mean, come on, it's gotten to the point of insanity and you're seeing it now. So when the Fed cuts again, I mean, that's kind of when all heck breaks loose, which is why they so don't want to go there until they're pretty sure inflation is not going to come roaring back. And the only place from which that can happen is deep in an economic abyss. And the Fed better be careful, because the last thing you want, worse than an inflation, and this is always what they'll always choose to reflate, which is why the Fed will do what they have to do, is a debt deflation. And you have so much debt now, the Fed pushes too hard. They push us over the edge, and they cannot allow that to happen.
Let's look at the stock market. I mean, we can see that without the input from the mega cap tech stocks, the stock market really hasn't gone anywhere this year. But, I mean, you know, Apple, Microsoft, and so on, Google, and all are there. They're huge, and the stock market has been working its way higher. So if... And I used to write about the during the period, what was like throughout 2022, as the Fed was raising rates, the market kept anticipating, you know, once the Fed stops and starts to ease, that'll be a green light special to buy stocks.
Right.
Because, you know, the Fed's been hitting us in the eye by raising interest rates. Once they stop hitting us, you know, stock prices are going to go higher. But now, if the Fed cuts now, is that... like, and they're cutting because they're worried. Is that a green light special for stocks or something else?
Well, I don't think the Fed would be cutting unless stocks are off. I think that's, to me, like almost the last straw that the Fed needs to see. I mean, they talk about the labor market, they talk about the credit dynamic, they talk about all these other things, and you have them. I mean, the consumer's choking, retail sales are horrifying, they're recession like numbers. You can look at a few spots and services if you want to use some of the surveys, ISM and so on, to pick out some strong numbers. But generally speaking, even when you take employment, all right, people are still dropping out, man. And it's not like, you know, the participation rate is going nowhere. So, you know, there's a lot of caveats to the thought that the employment market is strong. And in fact, it is softening. Layoffs have hit records for February, is the largest layoffs we've seen since 2009 for the month of February. You know, so we have a lot of holes in that whole dynamic. But I think, you know, stock market coming to grips with the economic realities would be a big downturn, which might cause the Fed to actually have to move. I don't see them. I think they are loath to even discuss, and it's clear from their comments they are, to even discuss a turn in policy when gold's at $2,000 and the stock market's not that far from record highs. They just don't want to. You know, so I think it's more pain, and this is the game they're playing, because a debt deflation would be the worst thing possible, and there's no playbook for that. So we'll see, but I think ultimately, you know, there's not a problem with the stock market rising with gold and rising with all these things, because ultimately it's a dollar down thing that's going to happen the next time they want to stimulate the economy and keep the economy from taking us into a debt black hole, and that's going to be the next big fight. Okay, that's certainly not this year, probably into next year, whenever it might be, we'll see it coming. But I think first the stock market wobbles, even though it doesn't look like it. And if it doesn't, then you're in a situation where, hey, okay, the Argentinian real makes a new high every year. What does that mean for the, you know, standard of living? Not a heck of a lot. It really doesn't. What it means is you're devaluing their currency, which boosts the value of your stock prices as it boosts commodities, as it boosts inflation. So we have high inflation and it's a high stock market. The question is, are your stocks keeping pace with the debasement of your money? That's the next big phase, Victor, and this is the next big battle for retail investors, is when the Fed does turn, will your investments keep pace with the rate of inflation that's going to result from that?
Now, we're going to switch gears a bit here and talk about how Greg actually approaches the market as a trader. But before I mention that, I want to give you Greg's website. It's Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N, WeldonOnline.com. As I said at the top, I've known Greg for 20 years. He is a macro guy, looks at all kinds of markets. Markets, you think, why the hell would you look at that? You know, but you know, you find stuff in those different markets, that's for sure. So Weldon Online. Greg, let's talk about trading. And we've just, you know, we've got another 10 or 15 minutes here. I sit in front of my screens, and I've done that for years. I know some people that are really successful traders say, don't sit in front of your screens because you'll just, you know, you'll make some money, but then you'll lose it. I was going to say something else. You'll lose it because you just want to be busy. Right. I mean, do you trade, sit in front of your screens and look at it? And maybe even more important, what's the time frame that you have? And is it the same for everything that you do?
Good questions. And they're trick questions because they're really hard to answer, man. So, because they seem simple, but they're not. They really get to a big point in terms of, you know, whether you're going to be successful or not. Okay. You know, I'm in front of my screens all the time, but that doesn't mean I'm always focused on each market tick or this or that and the other thing. I don't watch it to that nth degree. All right. My time frames, to address the second part first, actually, is as long as possible. I mean, I want positions for months and months, beyond 12 months, 18, 24 months potentially. I've had positions that long. I've had, you know, owned copper for 2 years, you know, not touched it, you know, it's that kind of thing. That's the ideal thing, is it's trading slash investing, because I'm not a trader. I'm not looking to scalp the market. I'm not looking to be in and out. Rare that I have in and out on the same day. And if I do, it's because I was really wrong with my timing and I got stopped out already. All right. That's the only way I'm in and out on the same day. All right. I look to hold positions for months. I want long-term themes that match off with long-term technicals. Now, that doesn't mean I won't play counter-trend moves. When I think you're in a position where the markets have had a big move and now you're going to get some counter-trend plays, well, you know, we are trying to provide a return for our customers. So, you know, there's not any one which type of market that I will be looking for necessarily. Having said that, I think the most important thing to address the first part of that is having a methodology. If you have a methodology, then you don't feel like you have to sit in front of the screens all the time. You kind of know what you want to do. You set your parameters, you set your goals, and certainly the markets change. And I think, you know, obviously they change a lot quicker than they used to because the information is so much more readily available and actionable. And, you know, you use a click of a button, you can, you know, move your money real quickly. But to the degree to which I still think that this is, you know, having positions, having stops, unless my opinion changes dramatically, I'm kind of just going to let my methodology work for me, so to speak. But within that context, you know, and I know, Victor, and you touched upon this earlier. If you go back to Van Tharp, if you remember Van Tharp, right, one of the greatest trading coaches in history, I've worked with some of the greatest traders in the world, guys that are in the books, literally. A couple of them I have worked with, I learned from, you know. I mean, I've worked for two of the most successful hedge funds in the history of hedge funds. So I've been lucky to have learned from some really smart guys. And they were all like Van Tharp guys too, right, way back in the day. And what Van Tharp says is this, 100%, okay, of trading, well, if you're going to be successful, 10% is your methodology. 10% is your methodology, 20% is your risk management, and 70% is psychology. Knowing yourself, because this is a war against your own psychology. You know, hope, greed, and fear, and those cliches, man, they are so applicable. And when you have a methodology that you've developed, worked with, believe in, whatever it might be, belief in your methodology is key, because you have to follow it, especially if you have had a methodology where you've lost money, because there's always drawdowns, man. No one makes money. Anyone that says they make money every month is doing something wrong, or going to blow up at some point, or is lying. Probably the latter, right? There are swings. It's a probability curve. Everything is. It's all math to me. I'm a math guy. Everything I do has a mathematical angle to it. When it comes to the trading, I might think gold's going to go up, but I'm not trading unless the math is there on the quantitative and technical side. All right. That's how I manage my risk. And frankly, we've had to change our risk metric a little bit because the markets are so much more volatile. They move so much more in a day. They're swinging around and chopping around a lot more. So you also have to be able to be somewhat nimble in kind of maybe tweaking your methodology when it makes sense, not because it wasn't working or something. And when you have a methodology where you've had drawdowns and come out of drawdowns and you believe in that methodology, there's nothing more empowering than that. But that also takes experience. It takes making mistakes. This isn't easy. You know as well as I do, this is really a hard thing to do successfully over the long term. And having a methodology you can believe in, having the psychology where, you know, you're not worried. It's almost like playing poker. It's like they're chips. It's not real money, but you have to treat it as if it's, you know, sacrosanct in the fact that it's real money, if that makes sense. So again, not an easy thing to do. And I think having a methodology, having a risk metric, an overlay that really has mathematical robustness that will, you know, keep you from hitting that probability of ruin. And he goes, that's the biggest thing you want to watch out for.
Well, yeah. I mean, we remember the era, and you and I are both there, like in the 70s and the 80s, when sort of the thing that the commodity traders wanted to do was to turn 10 grand into a million as fast as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to be a currency analyst for Conti, and I'd talk to, you know, hundreds of brokers over the Hoot and Holler line and trade my own account in front of those guys. And boy, did that ever sharpen my discipline. I mean, if I said I was going to be stopped out at such and such a level on the Hoot and Holler line, I got stopped out, you know. Yeah. When I observed hundreds and hundreds of people, clients in the brokerage business, lose millions and millions and millions of dollars, I said, you know, what is the thing that they have in common? And the thing that stood out to me more than anything else is that people hated to take a loss. They'd say, yeah, well, let's just give it a couple more days. I'm sure it's going to turn around, things yeah. like that.
Yeah. You have to completely shift your whole conditioning. And you hit on such a good point, because we are conditioned not to lose, man. Growing up, especially as, you know, kid, boys in this types of society that you and I live in, you know, you're brought up not to lose, do anything not to lose. And to the degree that if you can flip your own psychology, it's in remove the ego, because what you just said, it really comes down to ego, not being able to admit you're wrong. There's nothing to do with being right or wrong. It's about making money. Okay. And frankly, I'm wrong as often as I'm right. I don't have to be 90% right. I don't have to be right even more than I'm wrong. Why? Because it's like baseball. If you can hit a ball one out of three times, you're going to be in the Hall of Fame and make millions and millions of dollars. Why? Because that's what it takes mathematically to be successful. All right. If I can have a strategy where I'm making three times my average loss is my average win, and I'm right 50% of the time, I'm a rock star. And I'm right only half the time. It doesn't make any difference, right or wrong. Ego has to be removed. It's about the methodology. It's about the math. It's about giving yourself a chance to be successful in the long term using a mathematical overlay based on whatever your methodology may be. And it's very difficult these days. I mean, I put a stop in the second I enter a position. I don't get off that screen without entering the stop. I have already written down. I still do little tickets. If I was on the camera, I'd show you my little tickets I have right here. I have the big index cards. Why? Because it's something I write it down. I circle it. I know where my stop is. I've already figured out exactly what my dollar loss is. I try and limit my loss to 0.4%. Try and limit loss to 0.4% in these markets, Victor. It's very difficult. The problem with most people trading futures is they're undercapitalized. You can't take $10,000 and turn it into $1 million anymore. You can't, because $10 is 10 minutes in the gold market with one contract. All right. So these contracts have gotten so large and the swings are so big on a monetary basis. The moves are huge. So for me to try and limit, and $1 million is our minimum account, right, from accredited investors only. So that means each trade I have $4,000 worth of loss to work with. That really ain't much, man. But my stops are predetermined by the market. So I back engineer everything, okay? So I have $4,000. Well, the risk in gold is 10 bucks, right? I can trade four contracts, right? Because each $10 is $1,000 in one contract of gold, 100-ounce contract, right? So I can buy four contracts. I do my position sizing based on where my stop is and back engineer into my risk metrics. And this way I can keep everything solid and know that my probability of ruin is extremely small. I can also tell you from my personal standpoint, I happen to know where our kind of soft spot might be. All right. The soft spot might be that I see things before the general public sees them. You need the general public to see things to get the markets to move in that direction, because I see it. I'm not going to move the market. You need a level of awareness in some of the themes before the markets will actually move. And what I find funny is the epiphany day. I'll be looking at something for 2 months. I think something's going to happen in, say, soybeans, you know, and nothing's happened. The news is out there. Here's the numbers. This is really bullish, but the market's not moving. And someday some guy will say something, and all of a sudden it's like everyone's aware the soybeans are bullish because one person said something, or it was one particular stat, or it got a highlight on TV somewhere, and it's the day of epiphany and the markets move. I tend to be early, and I tend to give myself several chances to be wrong because I'm early, and I know I'm early. And in that vein, that's where we have our drawdowns. We have our drawdowns right before we go on some of our biggest runs because I'm early in the positions, and when they finally hit, we are all over them. So, you know, even knowing my own weakness, I can turn it into a strength because I tend to know when I'm, you know, when I'm early. And so then maybe you hold back a little bit and you give it a little more time, and bam, you're ready to step all over it when the time is right.
You mentioned you've worked for some of the major hedge funds. You know these guys. I like to say that I've met a few of those people, and I've certainly read about a lot more of them. And one thing I notice is that they are as dissimilar from each other as chalk is from cheese. What I take from that is, as a trader, you need to find a style that suits you. And you can't just wear somebody else's boots. And to find a style that suits you is probably going to take you years of trial and error, getting knocked around, and you finally kind of figure out what markets are good for you, what your time frame is good for you, what kind of sizing is good for you, what sort of expectations you have of yourself, and all of this stuff. You and I could definitely talk about this for hours and probably have a few cocktails while we're doing it. But let's maybe wrap it up here in the next couple of minutes for somebody that's pretty new to this game. You know, he's got some money, he's got some time, he's, you know, likes to pay attention to markets. What would maybe be one or two of the key things that he's got to understand before he's going to be successful?
That this is not easy. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme. Okay, I feel like during a pandemic, and especially with the advent of crypto tokens and commodities, I refuse to call them cryptocurrencies because they're not, but I'll sure trade them. I'll trade, you know, they're on a regulated futures market right now, Ethereum and Bitcoin. I trade them both. We've been very successful trading them. All right. But what I would say is, don't expect to make a fortune like, you know, overnight, man. That's not how it works. You know, if you got $10,000, you need to treat it like it's a million and treat it like each loss really matters, and not like, you know, risk everything on a couple of things or, you know, yeah, could that be successful? But it doesn't teach you the long-term discipline and lessons you're going to need to learn to do this over a long period of time. And it sets you up to potentially blow up. You know, seen it a lot of times. People that are really successful in the beginning that do this, that maybe, you know, get lucky with a couple of things, then they put all their eggs into one basket and they triple their money and they quadruple their money, and all of a sudden they think they really know what they're doing. Those are the people to stay away from in terms of investing with, because they're prone to blowing up. So be very small. Be within your range. You know, look at the things that you have some understanding about. Read. First of all, read. I mean, for me, when I first started in this business, one of the things I did was bought every book I could get on the subject. Same thing when I took up serious high stakes poker. I bought every freaking book I could learn. You know, I went and played in a big money tournament at the Trump Taj Mahal after watching it on TV on ESPN, right? So I went in there, you know, I'd played some poker in college and, you know, shot some pool and whatnot, all of us had. So I thought I knew, had some idea. I learned immediately. I had no clue what I was doing. My 10 grand was gone in less than an hour. And I mean, it was, you know, one of those things. And I literally, leaving Atlantic City to drive home, I stopped at Barnes & Noble and bought 5 poker books. So I think there's a lot to be said for reading, because that way you can get a feel for yourself and what kind of system, what kind of methodology might work for you. And then play it small. Small ball. It's all small ball. It really is. If you want to do this long term and be successful and grow a nest egg, and especially if you're young, okay, you might want to take a little bit more risk, but at the same time, man, small ball all the way.
I hear you on that, Greg. I refer to my trading size as chicken shit. I do, you know, I mean, I'm still here after 50 years, and if that's what I want, you know, that's what suits me anyway. Hey, Greg, it's just been super, buddy. It was great to see you out here for the World Outlook Conference and the speaker's dinner we had after that. It was a lot of fun. I wish you nothing but success with what you're doing. And folks, you know, I like Greg. He does good work. Weldon Online. Check it out. You get some of his reports. And I think you've got, well, whatever. Go there and see what's on offer. I'm a little confused here as to if we have some special offers right now.
No, we're just the normal grind it out every day. We're up there every day. We're trying to help you make money every single day. We give specific recommendations in foreign exchange, fixed income. You know, we're called the research that pays for itself because we – basically, it's not a cost. It's an investment that pays positive returns and has every single year for the last 25 years.
Greg, the old buddy, thank you for taking the time to chat with me here on Money Talks. I look forward to talking to you again, and I look forward to seeing you the next time we get together.
Absolutely. And I say one thing. I leave you with this. More golf. Get out there and work on your golf game, Victor. That's what I'm doing.
Okay, buddy. Enjoy. All the best. Cheers.
All right. Take care.